Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Mark Davin.
Welcome back to Guitar Radio Show, everybody. Today is an episode that is, to me, 6 years in the making. It's actually more like 30 years in the making. Guess how long I've known this guy. He is one of my idols as far as guitar playing goes. There's Jeff Beck and then there's him. And I've waited this long to really bug him to be on the show because I wanted there to be enough audience for that to happen. Because you're going to get to hear a guitar player that really, really created my maturation process and many, many other guitar players in New York and beyond, in the whole tri-state area. And he, it's so funny. Recently, I was jamming with somebody here in Austin at the Victory Grill, and I was playing some lines. And I went, and afterwards, someone played it back to me, and they went, "That's pretty good, man." I go, "Yeah, I stole that from John the Cat Gatto." He, like I said, one of my idols. He was in one of my favorite bands, one of the most unique bands I have ever heard in my life, still to this day. And he was also my guitar teacher in the 80s. And I like to think of him as a friend as well. Folks, please welcome to the show, John the Cat Ghetto. John, welcome to Guitar Radio Show.
Oh, gee, Mark, thank you so much. That was some intro. Really, thank you so much. You had a lot of kind words there, and I very much appreciate it. And I'm glad that we have been friends for over 30 years. So thank you.
Long time, man. Well, yeah, what I, you know, it's so funny. In all the years I've known you, there's a lot of things that I never even asked you. Things about your origins and stuff like that, because whenever you and I were in the basement over at Focus, we were in the basement and I was taking lessons from you. I was just so in awe to be in the same room and so psyched that there were times I didn't even think to ask questions, and there were certain questions that I've always wanted to ask. First and foremost, you're such a unique, you have such a unique sound, such a unique approach. Your voice, the way you voice a guitar solo is completely different than anybody I've ever heard. Who was the guitar player that you first heard, or musician that you first heard, that you said, oh, I want to do this?
Well, obviously, I mean, the band had been very diversified. Oh, so yeah. There were a lot of guitar players, of course, that I, you know, grew up listening to. So depending on the category of, you know, the genre of music we're talking about, but it had to start out, of course, with the Eric Clapton, you know, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, really were those guys, you know, Leslie West, Alvin Lee, I think is what really, you know, inspired me to want to really do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, of course, listen, in 1964, I was 10 years old watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and the Beatles came on, and of course, that inspired. That was like a total change in one's life and for so many millions of other people. Mm-hmm. But between the Beatles and then, of course, as, you know, as we got more into the late 60s, those other guitar players certainly were the template from not only myself, but I'm sure for millions of others.
Yeah, I you know, it's funny too, because you never ended up sounding like any of those guys, though.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, at a young age, I always felt that, you know, those people were them, and you just had to be yourself. And it sort of continues that way, you know, because there are certainly a lot of people that are in cover bands today and you know, doing other people's songs, which is fine. But I've chose, you know, not to do that. And I've chose to just stay, you know, true to myself and try to be as original as one can be. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm sure you could hear little influences of all those guys that I mentioned, you know, in a song. But, you know, you do try to create your own. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I try to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, honestly, the only person I could possibly reach for that you were shooting to sound like or accidentally sounded like was the initial really clean jazz guitar solo in Fred Upstairs and Ginger Snappers. You sound like Les Paul.
Well, that's exactly, yes. It's exactly what it was supposed to be.
Yeah, it worked. And it worked for the song.
The innovator himself, you know, Les Paul. I mean, come on, you know, one of the greats. Sure, that was a big influence in that sort of jazz, you know, style of playing. Mm-hmm. You know, the big influence, you know, and of course, you know, Django Reinhardt, you know, those two guys together, you know, really created something, you know, absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you picked it out.
Yeah.
The secret is out.
And so you joined the Good Rats in 1972, was it?
No, it's actually like the mid-1973 is when I joined them.
Okay. You know, it's interesting because I was listening back to the very first Good Rats record, which came out in 1968. And
right.
It is, you know, it is definitely, and I don't know if it was, you know, you can hear already, you know, that sound that that Pepe and Mickey were bringing as far as the harmonies, their vocal harmonies, and of course Pepe's amazing vocal, but the songs, even though they were predominantly Pepe tunes, they were very 60s, very Yardbirds, very Vanilla Fudge, you know what I mean? And I don't think until you, Lenny, and Joe came into the band that it didn't become the Good Rats that we all know. Would that be a safe estimate?
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I know that, you know, Pepe as a songwriter, you know, and certainly his brother, I mean, they were progressing as, you know, they were, you know, getting more into songwriting, of course, and Mickey, you know, getting, you know, certainly better at as a guitar player, right? I mean, that's our the steps that we go through. Mm. But I think that once we got this combination, I think it really did work. And I think that, you know, Pepe, you know, of course, wrote all the songs. You know, he wrote all the instrumentals. And, you know, we just seemed to click, and we really wanted it to make it work. And we had the same goal. So, yeah, I think that that combination was certainly the best combination.
Yeah, I mean, it's the one that I saw first, obviously. And, you know, I tell you a quick story. Because of you guys and Twisted Sister in the club, back in the club days, you know, you guys were playing predominantly, you know, you were playing clubs, you were playing some theaters, and then eventually you played big rooms. You played Coliseums, and you played the Hammersmith Odeon and stuff like that. But when you guys were really pounding it out in the club scene, I was too young to get in. So back in the day, I could get on the Long Island Railroad, go into Manhattan, walk up to Times Square, and when it was really seedy, as you remember, and yeah. For $20, I went and I bought fake proof that made me 18 years old, so I could get in to see you guys. So I got on a train without my parents knowing. I don't know, I was 15 or 16 years old. Without my parents knowing, I got on a train. I went there. I laid down the money. And then I got my fake proof. And I was able to go see you at, you know, at Hammerheads and Speaks. And oh, God, you guys even played Good Times, right? You guys did Good Times of Massapequa Park and Comac, right? And I would figure out a way to get there. I made sure that I made friends with people who were older than me that drove, and I said, "You got to drive me to the Good Rats show."
Well, you know, it's great that you got proof. We actually had young kids that would wait at the door when the road crew would get there,
mm-hmm.
And then the road crew would actually let, you know, one of them in or two of them in, and they actually became sound companies. That are out there, you know, it's like an amazing thing that that influence was there. But, you know, I'm sure that there is an influence with every band that's out there that you know, creating music. And I think that, you know, that's not, you know, abnormal. I think it's the norm.
Yeah.
Great to bunk into those people years later and knowing that we were an influence to them, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's really what it's all about, right? I mean, really, it's about people that are really delivering something special like you guys did. And it inspires. And however it inspires, whether it's musically or in the direction of providing sound and visual support, whatever the influence is, it's a positive thing. It's a beautiful thing. And that's something, I'll tell you, man, you guys were so, so such a positive influence on me that, what was it? I think it was junior year in high school or senior year in high school. I convinced my cover band, my garage band, to open with Detroit. So we did take it into Detroit to open with at a battle of the bands.
Listen, I that's great. You know, I'm glad you did it. Thank you.
The funny thing, too, is that night, Apparently, Mark Mendoza from Twisted Sister was in the audience that night because his cousin was in another band that we were playing against. We beat his cousin's band, and he came over and he said, "Hey, that was a good verse in Detroit." I go, "Hey, thanks." And I recognize who he was. He goes, "But you guys shouldn't have won. My cousin's band should have won."
Mark is a great guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. And he's just a great person, fun guy, great player.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. One of my big thrills too was, and I'll stop talking about me in a second, but one of my big thrills, because this is so exciting for me, when you guys did one of your reunion shows, it was around Thanksgiving, you guys played at a place called Lemoore Far East. My band Teaser was already, we were doing a lot of headlining gigs at that point, all original band, just like you guys. And a call came in and said, "Hey, do you guys want to open for the Good Rats for one of those reunion shows, for the Thanksgiving show?" I said, "Yes, and we'll do it for free. And we're ready to go. Just call us. How long you want us to play? We'll play 10 minutes if you want. I don't care what it is." And we got to open for you guys. And one of the greatest things for me was turning around and looking behind my amp, and there you are standing there watching me play. It was an amazing night for me. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for playing. Thank you for opening up for us.
I remember telling the audience, I said, "Hey, we're going to make this set as incredibly short as possible because I want to get down in front and watch the Good Rats." And the crowd went crazy. It was fun. I always wondered, when you came into the band, I noticed especially on that first Good Rats record, there wasn't a lot of these guitar harmonies, these dual guitar harmonies that were going on between you and, you know, that eventually went on between you and Mickey. How'd that get started between you guys? Was that a Pepe thing, bringing Pepe? Pepe was like, I hear two guitars doing this, or was it that you and, you know, Mickey said, "Hey, let's try that"?
Well, no, I mean, there was another guitar player that was sort of like in the interim of the first Good Rat record, and then one before, you know, and then before the Tasty record, there was a guitar player. And so they obviously, well, you know, Pepe was writing the songs, and I think that already had started with the other guitar player.
Right.
I think as the group that you know of, you know, of us, you know, the original band, I think more guitar stuff was coming into play, and Pepe was writing, more instrumentals, which, you know, lend itself to having, you know, harmonies in the guitar parts.
Right.
So we would all sit down and, you know, work on the parts. You know, Mickey was a very important part of that. First off, he was Pepe's brother. He had worked with him for certainly a long time. Understood, I think, the Pepe's logic of what he wanted, and we, you know, would really work hard in getting those, you know, getting those solos down or getting those instrumentals down. Was it just sort of became more than probably they did in the earlier days, mm-hmm. you know, prior to the span.
Yeah. So when did the track Rat City in Blue come around?
We used to rehearse, you know, every day. Mm-hmm. If we weren't on the road or in the studio, we actually rehearsed. It was like a job. Mm-hmm. We like at noontime, and like we'd end like around 5 o'clock, maybe just enough time to kind of get home and you know, get ready for a gig. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the earlier days when we were doing, you know, the clubs. I lost the question. I'm so sorry.
So what, Rat City in Blue?
Oh, with Rat City Blue. Pepe came down, you know, to rehearsal, and he had this, you know, and he had the whole thing written out. You know, he had the whole song, or the whole instrumental, and then we just included that song. There's a middle section in there which actually used to be called the Clumsy Burglar, and it was a separate piece, and we never put it on a record, but we put that piece into Rat City in Blue, and it, which then became the instrumental with Rat City in Blue. So that's kind of how that came about.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So I heard you once say that, you know, that it was happening in New York. I know that was happening in New York, that as you guys were coming up and really starting to really start to make a name for yourselves, that also at the same time you had folks like, you know, all these different gear companies that were coming out, like the Dario Strings and MXR pedals. And they were all coming out of New York for the most part, DiMarzio pickups and stuff like that. And, you know, and you guys got to kind of almost test drive a lot of this stuff early on, and you had some really amazing and interesting sounds. One of the coolest things that I ever heard, and I've never heard another band do it before or since, was you guys using the Ebos in guitar solos, particularly on Don't Hate the Ones That Bring You Rock and Roll, the dual guitar solo that you guys are doing on with the Ebos. Where, how did that all happen? How did you get turned on to the Ebo?
You know, I don't actually recall how we got with the Ebos. I do believe it may have been Mickey who saw that, you know, the Ebo, and then we, you know, then a solo was written with it, and then we just, you know, both ended up using them.
Yeah.
You know, I still have my original Ebos. I have two of them.
The metal ones?
Yeah, the little chrome metal ones. Yeah. And they used to come with a holster.
Yeah.
And but, you know, never used a holster. We used to actually fling them to our road guys, and they would fling them to us, you know, when we needed it for a part. But, yeah, it was. I don't remember anybody using it at the time. No. And you're 100% correct. There were all these companies that were in the New York area that were starting to manufacture their product. Mm-hmm. And we happened to be, you know, kind of like at the right place at the right time. And, you know, some of those companies were actually fans of the band. So we got to try out their pedals. And still to this day, I still use that MXR, you know, Phase 90, you know.
Wow.
So a lot of those products that came out at that time is still part of my, you know, gear.
Wow, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, and Diodario, of course, had, you know, was in Farmingdale,
right?
And then I actually approached them to make like strings for me, which they did, because I was always a you know, I was a big guitar collector, and you know, I was always into, you know, trying out stuff and seeing what works better. You know, I was one of those geeks that kind of did that. So I asked them, you know, if they would make strings, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was a great time, you know, and DiMarzio too, Larry, you know, another one, you know, would make pickups, and, you know, I put them in the guitars and, you know, try them out. And he also did that for other bands that were, you know, in the New York area, you know, that had more access to get to his place. I believe it was in Staten Island at the time.
Yeah, it was. That's right.
Yeah. So, I still have pickups that he made. Back in, you know, in like that 74, 75 time period, you know?
And, you know, there is a difference too. Don't you think there's a difference between what was then and what was now?
Well, obviously it does appear to be that way. And you know, sometimes I wonder if it's only because, you know, as you get older, you look back and you say that was the best times. But, yeah, you know what? There was something about it. I think what made it special is that, the whole world really didn't know about it at that particular time, and it kind of felt like you kind of like found it yourself.
Yeah.
And it kind of like meant a lot to you, you know, kind of like figuring out what works better. Today it seems a lot more commercialized. It seems like, you know, your next door neighbor knows about it, you know, and the kid across the street knows about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great for the manufacturers, of course, right? They sell more product. But it felt more underground, and I kind of missed that.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, yeah, and you'd go into a guitar shop or something like that. Like, you know, I go to Grayson's and talk to Gary Blankberg over at Grayson's, and he would say...
Yeah, I still speak to Gary, by the way.
Oh, yeah? How's he doing?
Oh, he's fine. Yeah, I do see him occasionally. We go for, like, a little, you know, lunch or breakfast.
Yeah.
He's a great guy, and he's, you know, I'm glad he's still with us, you know?
Yeah, he is a great guy. I love how cranky he is.
But that's what gives him his character.
That's all, yeah. I mean, he worked on my the first guitar I ever bought with my own money. I brought it to him, and he worked on it, and I still have that guitar. So, yeah, you know, he was great. He was a mentor also, you know, as far as turning me on to different gear and stuff like that, for sure.
Right. The whole gotta be a little twisted if you paid to hear us. From my parents' house, and after elementary school and high school, I used to go there because it was legitimately two blocks away,
right,
in a little group of stores. And he's the one that actually, you know, I was able to see these vintage guitars.
Right.
He was like one of the first vintage guitar collectors.
Ronnie DiMarino?
Ronnie DiMarino, uh-huh. Yeah, he eventually worked with John Lennon. He was John Lennon's guitar tech.
Wow.
Yeah, and Ronnie's still around, okay? And it was really because of his store that I would go there after, you know, classes and, you know, see these vintage guitars. And that, you know, I could hold it in my hand. And I, you know, really became, you know, not only, of course, be a guitar player, but it made me even want to be more of a collector of guitars, because I was seeing these guitars and I was touching these guitars and I was getting an education, you know, from him.
Right.
So, yeah, so we all have that mentor, you know, and really appreciate that he was legitimately right down the street from my parents' house.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, and that's something else about you that I've noticed is that, and I've seen you, I mean, all through the years that I saw you play, you know, when I first saw you play, you were playing primarily Les Pauls. And,
yes.
And then you moved over to the Cat guitars, which we're going to talk about in a second. But I've seen you play Gretsch's and this really interesting custom guitar that you've been playing or you were playing in the early 2000s that I want to ask you about as well. But, you know, the thing that I always was curious about is, how did you always end up sounding like you, no matter what guitar you were holding? You kind of, to me, are like proof that it's really not about the gear so much. It's about the flesh, you know? It's about the fingers.
But you know what? You hit it on the nose, and that would certainly apply to any of the great guitar players that are out there. It really is in the hands, right?
Right.
We think that it's in the equipment at first, and we as we grow up, you know, and having people that we admire, like other guitar players, you know, like a Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page or anything like that, we think that we have to kind of get the same gear that they're using to sort of create their sound.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that that's not the case.
Right.
Okay? We know that it's in your own ears and it's in your hands that are really creating the sound. That the guitar is just a tool and the amp is just a tool, but it's you who are, you know, creating the magic, right?
Yeah.
So I realized that, you know, early on. And that's when you mentioned about the cat guitar and then you mentioned the other guitar. That's kind of how I came about doing that. I actually kind of did it as a goof.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cat guitar was, you know, I was thinking the rat. You know, my nickname was the cat.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, you know, maybe it would be a cool idea to have this guitar shaped like a cat and use it. And, you know, people would say, oh, you know, what is that you're playing? Or it's my own guitar. But, you know, yet you sound the same as you played with the other guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was a goal.
Mm-hmm.
To try to, you know, in a goofy kind of way to say, hey, listen, all you guys out there, it really is how you play. It's the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, of course, your fans, if they are your fans, they're going to love what you do, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So it really makes no difference whether you used a Les Paul or if you had somebody make a custom-made guitar. And at that particular time, custom stuff, you know, you could buy the necks, you could buy the bodies, was just starting to come into play.
Right.
And, of course, when Van Halen came out, you know, and he was using the Frankenstein guitar, you know, it was basically, there's the proof, you know, that you can really put something together and make it sound unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, which, by the way, I did give Eddie Van Halen a cat guitar.
I know, and then he went and he painted it with all those stripes on there.
Yes, he did. And there actually is a photo, you know, on Facebook, you know, going around. So there is proof of it.
Yeah, I think I sent you one.
Oh, maybe it was you who sent that.
I think it was, yeah. I think I sent you one. Yeah, actually, folks, when you go to guitarradioshow.com to listen to this episode, I know you're listening to it all over the planet, but if you go to guitarradioshow.com, I'm going to have photos of the cat guitar and John and the good rats, and I'll also include that picture of Eddie Van Halen playing the cat guitar as well.
Yeah, so, you know, but in any event, that's how that came about.
Yeah.
So it was really kind of done as a goof.
Yeah,
and but it kind of stuck a little bit, and you know, I'm kind of glad, you know, for that.
It was a cool guitar. The cat guitars were cool. I actually almost you and I were talking. I almost had a left-handed one made for myself at one point. I really dug the pickup selector switch at the head of the cat where the eye would be. If you pressed it in, it was a press button. You pressed it in, and it would show up red, right, when you turned it on.
It was just a selector for the pickup. That's
right.
All it was.
Right.
And it would be like a Yamaha console, came from a console switch.
Oh, really? Is that where it came from?
Yeah, and then I had ones in different colors. Some were orange, then one would be green, one would be blue.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. My favorite was the red one. That was my favorite.
Yeah. Well, those are the experimental times, you know, when, you know, like kids do today. I'm sure, you know, you try different pickups out. You try do this. You try that. You know, different tones, push pull pots.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, it was all experimental, you know, and it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, it really was a lot of fun back then.
Yeah. Tell me about that Sunburst Strat with the volume control up at the upper horn.
Okay, again, kind of done as a goof.
Uh-huh.
But the idea of it was, is, you know, everybody, you know, you always have the volume control and tone control, you know, on the bottom of the guitar, right? And I said, you know what a pain in the neck that is all the time. Why not just put it in the front, right on the top horn?
Yeah.
So I had a friend of mine who built guitars, and I said, listen, let's just make a Strat body. We used a rosewood fingerboard, And instead of using a Strat headstock, I use a Tele headstock.
Right.
Just no tone control, just a toggle switch, and the one volume control up on the top horn. Mm-hmm. And it actually worked out good because sometimes on stage, you may not be able to see a little bit other than, I mean, you're going by feel and you're going by, you know, you're hearing it. But I just wanted something that was right on the top there that I could basically see. Mm-hmm. And I used that guitar for a couple of years, you know. I used to bring out some of the old guitars when we were playing, but then I just said to myself, you know what? Who cares? Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's really, do all the fans really care that you're playing a 59 Cherry Burst Les Paul? You know what I mean? It's like, so I put a lot of those guitars in storage at an early, early time.
Yeah.
And that's when we came out with the Cat guitar. I said, you know what? If you know, let me carry a few of those around. If something happens to them, who cares?
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's like, it's like what Billy Gibbons does now. All those really amazing looking guitars that we see him playing, those that look like vintage guitars, they're all replicas. All the real ones are put away. Those are all John Boland replicas that he makes, and he chambers everything, including the headstock. So they're super duper light, and you know, they look like the real deal, and they sound great, but they ain't the real deal.
Yeah, Billy Gibbons is one of my favorite guitar players.
Yeah, he's great.
He was just such a unique guy. He's, you know, in fact, I'm going to be seeing him in October. I mean, I've seen ZZ Top many, many times, but I may actually, hopefully, have an opportunity to meet him, and that would be like just a great thing.
He's a really sweet guy, and I think you'll enjoy him. I really do.
Yeah, I think so.
Hey, I love all your guitar solos, but there's one that kind of stands out, and I'm curious to know when you work on a solo, I noticed that I followed you around so many times. I think I might have seen you play live. Honestly, I probably saw you play more than 100 times live. And, you know, there are aspects of the solos that I think that you actually did plan out because you would play them, you know, you play them, but then you would go off. How much of your construction of a solo is head? And how much of it is heart?
When we did play out, we really did try to do it like the record. Obviously, I mean, you've come to see the shows.
Right.
So once the solo was basically established, that's what we would play. But if there was a nine, or you know, you feel like just changing a little bit, there may have been maybe a different bend, or there could have been maybe a different choice note. Okay, but it basically stayed what the original solo was that was put on the record.
Yeah.
But you know what, though? I like to think of it that every night that we played, and this goes certainly for everybody in the band, that our heart was 100% into it every night.
Yeah.
And so if the solo may have had like maybe a little different maybe a little softer or a little harder or something like that is only the way you may have felt that particular evening.
Mm-hmm.
The solos basically were the same, a lot of time, unless maybe we may have done like some other instrumental or something like that where it was more of a free for all,
right?
You know, but it was pretty structured.
Well, I mean, I remember that, you know, and I'm not a huge Styx fan. But the only reason I actually ended up buying a ticket to see them was because you guys were opening for them at the Nassau Coliseum. And you did the guitar solo to Injun Joe in the three. You were using a wireless unit, obviously. And you went up into the 300 section. Way up there. This is a 15,000, 16,000 seat hall. And you went up into the 300 section and you played the guitar solo up there with a single spotlight on you. And you went off, boy. You went off that night. It was a whole, I mean, because it was you guys extended the solo that night for that, obviously for that purpose. So I imagine it had to be like you were pulling all the tricks out of the bag for that.
that definitely was a great time. And you know, just for the record, there had been nobody
right
at that particular time ever going wireless into the audience.
Right. That had never happened.
Now it's like a stable.
Yeah.
You know, just because they put the stage out, you know, in the middle of the, you know, the floor there, and people are, you know, all over, you know, flying around and all that stuff. But at that particular time, there was nobody that was doing that. and also, that wasn't like a switchable channel wireless.
Right.
It came out like a couple of years later. So we were like, you know, I was stuck on one channel. So if there was an interference, it was really like, you know, the luck of the card there. I mean, it really was, you know, taking a chance.
Right.
But yeah, that was great. The only thing I didn't realize back in that day is that there's a delay factor. So the further you go from the band, you know, the more of a delay factor came into play. So I sometimes think to myself, how did we pull that off? But it did work out really great. And I appreciate that you remembered that, because I do bump into people that say, hey, I remember seeing you up in the, you know, the 300 section, you know. Mm-hmm. And I did that no matter where we played, whether it was a big, you know, a Coliseum type atmosphere, or even if it wasn't a club, would always like appear somewhere in that room, right, you know, playing that solo to Injun Joe.
Right, right. You know, and another thing too that you guys did that I had seen you do, and then when I saw AC/DC do it, I was like, hey, what the hell? They're ripping off the Good Rats. Was when Pepe used to pick you up on his shoulders and carry you around.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something that we just worked out, you know, and said, look, why don't I jump on your shoulders? And we did that for Local Zero.
Right, the Local Zero.
Yeah. Right. You know, hey, I only fell twice. So not so bad in all those years. I fell once at CBGB's, and I fell, I don't know, one of the other places. But we always had a guy that was like sort of behind me in case I did fall.
Right.
So I never hurt myself in the two times that I did it. You know, two times that I fell, considering that we used to do that every night. But yeah, it was just something that Pepe and I worked out. And then I also noticed that I think it was somebody in Quiet Riot that the guitar player jumped on his shoulders too.
And I'm trying to
figure out, like, did we do it first?
Yeah.
You know, one thing I'm not too sure about, but I certainly was not influenced by Quiet Riot doing it. You know, so whatever we came up with Pepe was really kind of like at a spur of the moment, and then if it worked, we would just continue to use it in the show. We'll be right back.
So another thing that people, you know, and I'm hoping that people are really getting to grok here as they listen to this episode with all the music interspersed, is it was really kind of unheard of at that time, and even now, it was kind of unheard of for a rock band, and to call you guys a rock band was really kind of not really on the money at all. For a rock band to play rock tunes on a record or live, hard rock tunes, blues, jazz, and even country and progressive music, progressive rock music. Did you find that was, I mean, you guys had such a huge audience everywhere I ever went to see you play, and I saw you guys play in Connecticut, I saw you play in New Jersey, I saw you play all over the place, and you always had big audiences. What do you think was the reason that, even though you were doing so many different styles, that everybody was like, yeah, this is, you know, they didn't put any label on it. It was hard to label you guys. But what do you think it was that people were like, yeah, this, they're incredibly accepting of it?
I think when people went, they just were entertained.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Pepe and Mickey would always, you know, have a show within themselves, right? In their communication.
That's true.
You know, and the audience, you know, felt part of it. Yeah. It's sort of like seeing like a Don Rickles, you know, two Don Rickles kind of like talking to each other, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then the band was great. You know, the musicianship was really good.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And then you had the songs on top of it. So you had this like entertaining kind of show where I don't think that you were getting that from, you know, other bands,
mm-hmm.
You know, and as far as the diversity of the music, I mean, it's great that we did that. You know, we did a little jazz stuff. We did progressive stuff. You know, we did the little country thing. It's great, but maybe that could have been not good. Because really, really, maybe we couldn't get labeled as this particular kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like I, when I see people, they always talk about Tasty. You know, certainly the album Tasty, and they certainly talk about the song Tasty. But you know, if I had to pick a song, I'd say Take It to Detroit
yeah.
would be a good representation of the band.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, I would agree with that. Absolutely. I mean, and I guess maybe also for me, it's the first song I ever heard by you guys. So I was, and the lyrics. And the guitar solo and that's another thing, is your melodic lead work, not just in the solo, but how you would establish a theme. You know, that whole boo, with that mother tone, you know, that amazing, you know, I don't know, were you using front pickup for that?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's got that really round, full sound in those single notes, you know, that you always did that. I mean, you did that with Does It Make You Feel Good? I mean, on and on and on. You would do that with songs establishing themes, you know. So I definitely think that, you know, and there was hooks too. It was hooks. You're right. It was entertainment. It was hooks. It was good songs. Great playing. Yeah.
Joe was a dishwasher in old Jackson City. Lenny was a cook in Santa Fe. Nicky ran the numbers for a friend in Nevada. And I'm getting fatter every day. Might as well get back to my music. To my music. Might as well get back. Get back, Ted.
He played the big street for a while.
Joined the city of the
So what have you been working on? What have you been doing?
Well, you know, I do a lot of studio work, so I keep busy with that. And, you know, I'm trying to enjoy life a bit. You know, I mean, obviously I'm not a 20-year-old kid anymore. So I'm just trying to, you know, enjoy myself. I you know, I play every day. I'm in the studio. You know, I help out some of the new talent that's out there, and hopefully, you know, they'll make a mark. But, you know, they're all young kids. You know, whether they're young bands or whether they're like singers, either female or male. And, you know, just I'll always be a guitar guy. You know, music is in you. You know, it's like the Godfather. You know, you try to get out, but they pull you back in. I think once we do this, we never get out of it.
No.
We make it frustrated, of course, but I think everybody does.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you do things for so many years, I mean, the Rats have been together 43 years.
Wow.
That's a long time.
Wow.
Right? So you kind of need a break a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
But I did work out in California. You know, I did some movie soundtracks. You know, I've kept myself busy through the years. But now I'm just trying to enjoy myself. And, you know, I'm involved with Gretsch Guitars now. So that's great. You know, I've got something new now to add to the collection, you know, of all these Gretches, other than some old ones that I had.
Right.
But, yeah, just trying to keep busy, you know, hang out with some musician friends. What do you do when you're like at 60 years old? That's what you kind of do.
But I love that you're still creative. I love that you're still playing and you do what you do, because, you know, you're one of those people. You're another one of those people that carry the torch, you know. I gotta tell you, John, I got so many questions answered today that I didn't, you know, that I've been wanting to ask you for 30 years.
Well, I hope I answered them. You know, as I hope you're happy with those answers.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to go back a little bit. You know, so many years ago, but. All I could say is simply this: the Good Rats was a great band to be in. Everybody in the band was all for each other.
Yeah.
The music is what we believed in. Okay, sure, every band has their arguments and a screaming match. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you know, it's sort of like it became like a little gang, you know, your group become your own little gang, and everybody watched out for everybody, and everybody had a great time performing, and if anything is going to be left, as long as music, that's the legacy, right? It's the music.
Yeah.
Personalities don't mean much.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I tell you the memories that you have given me. And the gifts that you've given me, the musical gifts you've given me, and the time that you spent with me. I mean, I don't know if you realize, I studied with you for 2 years. I was one of your students for 2 years. I drove you crazy. But,
no, I don't think you drove me crazy.
I got so much out of it, man. It really was a great gift.
Well, that makes me happy, you see, because at least, you know, if you get something out of it, okay, what more can one ask for?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I know at the time that doing the lesson thing, it was just when the band actually broke up.
Yeah.
Because there was that 3-year period where we weren't, you know, playing together. And it wasn't until they came out with CDs is when we actually got back together and we did those reunion shows.
Right.
Okay. So that little time period there, we're basically trying to, you know, give lessons to the people who were like Rat fans. You know, it just kind of worked out that way. And that, what did it last, 2 years tops?
Yeah, something like that.
So, yeah. But I'm glad that you were a part of that. And I'm glad that you remember and learned something from it. You know, and that makes me feel really good. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you. John Gatto, thank you for everything you've done. And thanks for being on Guitar Radio Show today, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
All right. You hold on 1 second, but we're going to sign off right here.
My wipers aren't clear, my view freezing my ass cause my heater's busted, skin turning bluer than blue, and my tires are full, but loving it all, fornicating on the wet road. Mr. Mechanic, I started to panic, hit the brake, fluid was low.
Coming back for more.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr, and of course, on guitarradioshow.com.